We're going to be continuing this evening in our I Am series, catching the next I Am statement that Jesus makes in John chapter 8, starting with verse 12. So if you want to go ahead and be turning there. You know, it was just a little over a year ago that we finally became homeowners. We'll be married 10 years here in a month. So it took us a while to get around to purchasing our first home. But, you know, now we have our own home and we have all the joys and all of the troubles and frustrations that come with that. And one of the unexpected, not frustrations, but maybe difficulties, is all of the light bulbs you have in your house. And particularly now, I feel like there are so many options on light bulbs. You know, we started getting these little curly-Q light bulbs that were supposed to be better for the energy, but we weren't supposed to break them. And now I think they're moving away from those, and they've got these LED lights. And, you know, it used to be back in the day, you got a light, you shook it, and you looked at it to see if the filament was broken or not. And if it wasn't, you got it, and you put it in, and if it had a number on it, you knew what it was going to look like. And now you have all of these kind of weird, you know, day glow lights. And if you notice, looking over here, we have one that kind of stands out on its own because, you know, you go there and you've got your soft white and you've got your daylight, day bright, white light, green lights, blue lights. There's just so many lights to get. You know, I go and I look, we say, oh, the front porch light is out. And I say, all right, which one of these is acceptable to put in a front porch? You know, I don't really know because there's so many different options out there. And of course, you know, 65 watts, you know, light. Well, now it's a 23 watt light. It's the same thing, but it's not. Light bulbs are a very difficult thing for us, and there's even impending laws about what light bulbs are allowed. But they're important, right? They're important. How would we feel if we were sitting around in the dark? Well, I know how we would feel, actually. The church we had in Boston, when we started meeting there, huge sanctuary, probably twice as long and twice as tall as this room. One light bulb. The whole place. No windows. It'd not be great. Kind of feels like you're in a cave. We like having lights. When the winter comes and we're having our 6:30 service at night and the sun's already gone down, it would be really difficult if we did not have lights. Light is important. Light is something that we naturally crave because it helps us to see better. It helps us to know where we are going better. It helps us to just live in a more efficient and enjoyable fashion. And that's somewhat of what it means for Jesus to be the light of the world. And we're going to look at that tonight. We're going to look at that statement that Jesus makes, that he is the light of the world, and discuss what that means. And I'm actually going to take kind of a backwards approach at this passage, because Jesus jumps right in, you know, with no concern for our verses and where things might naturally lead to. He jumps right in with the statement, I am the light of the world. And then there's this discourse that follows it. And what I want us to do today is I want us to first look at this discourse and this kind of disagreement that they're having. And then we'll return back to verse 12 where he talks about being the light of the world. So I'm going to read verses 12 through 20 and then we will begin opening up this text. It says, again, Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. So the Pharisees said to him, you are bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. Jesus answered, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I come from or where I am going. You judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true. For it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me. They said to him, therefore, where is your Father? Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, but no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. So what we're going to find in this passage as we read through it and open it up further is that though some may not see it, Jesus is the light that brings life to the world. So how do we get there? Well, again, first, what I want to do is I want to look at this disagreement that Jesus and the Pharisees were having. So starting in verse 13, after he's made a statement, the Pharisees said to him, you're bearing witness about yourself. Your testimony is not true. This thing he has just said, they're saying, well, that's not true. That's not a truthful statement. you're bearing testimony about yourself, and your testimony is not true. Now, what does this necessarily mean? Well, they have very specific grounds for what it means to have a true testimony, particularly in regards to the type of statement that Jesus made that we'll look at later in the Jewish culture and the Jewish law. And they're coming to him saying, you don't meet this. You don't meet the requirements for what we say are true statements, true witnesses, true testimonies about yourself here, Jesus. And Jesus has three rebuttals for him. His first rebuttal comes in verse 14. It says, Jesus answered, even if I do bear witness about myself, my testimony is true, for I know where I came from and where I am going. But you do not know where I come from or where I am going. So his first rebuttal to these Pharisees is that they don't know where he came from or where he is going. They don't know anything about his origins. They don't know anything about his mission. Right? And the book of John, here we're in chapter 8 of the book of John, and we're not doing a study on the book of John, but in the book of John is very clear about Jesus' origins. We read this just a few moments ago. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. Right? All things were made through him. It begins talking about his origins. Who is Jesus? The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. It says things like this. It tells us about his origins. And it tells us about his mission. It tells us where he is going, what he came to do. He came to bear testimony. We read back here in John 1. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as of the only Son of God from the Father, full of grace and truth. And from his fullness we all have received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Right? He came to bring us grace and truth. How did he do that? Well, that's partially what his I Am statements throughout the book of John tell us. They tell us how is Jesus bringing grace and truth to us when he comes into the world. The book of John consistently points out Jesus' origins and his mission, and it also points out the fact that the Pharisees and his own people weren't going to get it. John 1, verses 10 through 11 says, he was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, that's the Pharisees and the Jews, and his own people did not receive him. So when he says here, but you do not know where I come from or where I am going, he's just reiterating that fact. That fact that the Apostle John had given us in chapter 1, here Jesus is reiterating. You don't know who I am. You don't know why I'm here. And so when you start talking about things, about claims I'm making, about myself and what I am doing, you better be careful. Because you don't know. You're blind to it. You're in darkness. We know so many people today who know of Jesus, but they don't actually know anything about him. That's where these Pharisees were. They knew of Jesus. Maybe even at times they said, what good comes out of Nazareth? Right? They talk about his origins. They're the origins that they know of. They talk down about his raising and the situation of his birth because they don't know. So many people today want to talk about Jesus. They want to say, well, he was a good teacher. Maybe not God. No, he was a great man. He's a very humble man, loving man. And he was these things, but there's more. And the world knows of Jesus, but they don't really actually know anything about him, because if they did, if they knew about him the way that we come to know about him as believers, they would be convicted of their sin and see him for who he is, who he claims to be, which again, we will get to shortly. Jesus' next rebuttal for the Pharisees is this. Verse 15, you judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. Okay, now, we want to be careful with this one, because sometimes we say, well, Jesus comes to judge the world, and that's what he's going to do in his second coming. But he's just told them, you don't know where I come from, you don't know why I'm here. And this coming, the first coming, when Jesus first came to the world, He came to seek and to save the lost. So when he says, I judge no one, this isn't some sort of contradiction. He's just got done telling them that they don't know why he's there, and then he tells them, I'm not here to judge. And that is true about his first coming. Jesus came to seek and to save the lost. He came to die on the cross as a sacrifice for sins. When he comes again, he will come with judgment, as the Apostle Paul tells us later on in the New Testament. He says, you judge according to the flesh. I judge no one. They judge according to the flesh. They look around and they see what they see. Their story about who Jesus is, their story about what he's doing, why he's out there teaching and talking in this way. And they make judgments based on their own human wisdom, based on their own personal insight, based on the flesh. Not upon the contrast of that would be the Spirit. They're not judging by the Spirit within them. They're judging by their flesh. And they're judging incorrectly. Because as we know, the flesh is a very poor judge of heavenly things. Paul talks about this ad nauseum, it feels, in the book of 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 through 20 says, for the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing. Right? To those who are judging according to the flesh, the word of the cross is folly. But to us who are being saved, who are judging by the Spirit, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? And again, I really feel like that is what Jesus is saying in this moment to the Pharisees. He's saying, you judge according to the flesh, and my Father, he makes foolish the wisdom of this world. You don't know me, you don't know where I'm coming from, you don't know what I'm here to do, and you're making judgments based upon human wisdom, and the Father is going to make you look like a fool. Again, the question of right judgment must be considered. Are our conclusions about truth made by worldly wisdom or guided by the Spirit within us? And this is a difficult one for the church, and we find churches more and more going down the wrong path on this sort of thing. The contemporary issue of note is homosexuality and where the church lands on homosexuality. And they begin making judgments based on worldly wisdom. They say, well, the world no longer has a problem with homosexuality. And you know what? If we go through here and we do a lot of intellectual gymnastics and we put words into the Apostle Paul's mouth and we read things that they would never even thought about, then we can say we're okay with it too. Now, when we say that, of course, we want to say we are okay with the people. We want to welcome all people in here. But what we have to say is we're not okay with the act, with homosexuality as a lifestyle, because the Bible finds it to be sinful. We have to do this with other things as well. We have to make judgments based upon what the Bible says. And they're not always easy, they're not always fun, because the world and its wisdom rails against us. But we have to judge by the Spirit. We have to make our decisions by the Spirit and guide it in that way. And not in a hateful, better than thou type way, but in a way that says, listen, you know, we are guided by the Spirit of God that's inside of us, that reveals His truth to us. And it's not about me, right? It's not about my wisdom. It's not about my standing. Who is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has God not made foolish the wisdom of the world? Part of that is about saying God chose the weak, right? That's what Paul says elsewhere. He chose the weak to bring down the powerful, to bring down the strong. It's not about the world and what the world says. It's about what God says. And in this moment, it's not about what the world says about Jesus' origins, about what the world says about what he could possibly be and his testimony that he's bearing to himself. It's about what the Spirit that resides within him and will reside within his followers says and testifies about him, which is where he goes after that. Because in verse 16, he says, "Yet even if I do judge, my judgment is true. For it is not I alone who judge, but I and the Father who sent me. In your law it is written that the testimony of two people is true. I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me." They said to him, "Therefore, where is your Father?" Jesus answered, "You know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also." So what's going on here is this. The law has clear demands for legal verification on statements, particularly statements like this, which we're going to point out, basically, they would have found to be heresy. And so if he's going to make a statement like this, that if it's false, is a heretical statement, and that's grounds for being stoned to death under their culture. And for something to be legally verified as true, there must be two witnesses who come and testify to its truth. Deuteronomy 17:6 says, "On the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the one who is to die shall be put to death. A person shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness." And so here it's going the other direction. There it was a witness. Maybe somebody had committed a murder and they said, "We've got two witnesses to this murder. Therefore, we're going to find this person guilty." In this case, Jesus is, in a sense, condemning himself by making a heretical statement if that heretical statement turns out to actually be heresy and not be truth. And so he needs the two witnesses to come alongside of him to vouch for him, to justify his statement. And the witnesses, in this case, that he appeals to are Christ himself, the God-man himself. Now, how can he bear witness to himself? Well, you know, that's a tricky question for some commentators. Some commentators say he wasn't able to bear witness to himself. He's just kind of flouting the laws here. But what do we know about Jesus? We know that Jesus is incapable of lying. He always has to be true. And so he can't bear false testimony, and he is making statements that are bigger than him. You know, there are statements about himself, but they're about the Trinity. They're about God the Father. And so he stands as a witness there, and so does God the Father. Verse 18, "I am the one who bears witness about myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness about me." Elsewhere, he calls into his kind of defense John the Baptist and the scriptures. So there were plenty of things that testify to Jesus. This is a continuing argument that he's having with these Pharisees. This is nothing new. They're constantly trying to catch him on some sort of loophole. And so Jesus doesn't necessarily go through all the gamut that he does in John 5 of laying out witnesses that verify who he is. But we must know that if we'd have been reading this from the beginning to John 5 to here, that Jesus has already answered this question, already answered this claim against him that he is self-testifying and his testimony is not enough to give him legal verification. And here he's just saying again, listen, one, you don't know who I am. But if you knew who I was, you would realize that I can bear witness to myself. And then he says, "My Father," to which they ask, "Where is your Father?" And Jesus answered, "You know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also." And so he's basically saying to them, listen, if you knew the truth, if you knew the truth about who I am, who my Father is, if you really knew the Father. I mean, these are Pharisees. These are people who have committed their lives to being religious authorities. Their job description basically says that they know the Father, and yet Jesus is telling them, you don't. You don't. But if you knew me and you knew my Father, you would know the veracity of this statement. The problem isn't Jesus' lack of support. It's the Pharisees' blindness to the truth. Same way, we must realize that the world is not going to just follow the things that Jesus says. We can quote all the Bible verses we want, but the world isn't going to begin doing the things of God until they see Jesus for who he really is. And so we must remember, what is our calling? What are we to be doing? Are we to be going around telling everybody what they are supposed to do, or are we to be revealing the Father? Now, can those things go hand in hand? At times, yes. But you know, so often Christians want to be downers, saying what we can and cannot do. And lost, unbelieving world, they couldn't care less. Why should they care less? They don't know Jesus for who he is. So why would they care about the things he has said, the claims he is making? They're lost. They're in sin. They're depraved. They must see Christ for who he is before they can begin to live for him, at least in any meaningful way, in any saving way. And so who does Jesus say he is? Let's just return back to verse 12. Again, Jesus spoke to them, saying, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." He claims to be the light of the world. He says, "I am the light of the world." As we know, that "I am" is a loaded statement on its own. But then he adds to that, "I am the light of the world." And then he goes on to describe the ramifications of this claim. First of all, it's a claim to deity. "I am" itself is a claim to deity. By saying "I am," he's identifying himself with the God of the Old Testament. We mentioned that last week. We're going to keep mentioning it every week. If you don't take anything else away from this series, it's going to be the fact that when Jesus says "I am," he is claiming to be God. So if anybody ever asks you or says to you, "Jesus didn't really claim to be God," you've got 6, 8 different places you can point in the book of John. It says he claimed to be God here and here and here and here. But he doesn't just leave it at "I am" in this situation. He says, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." This is a further claim to deity because of when he made this statement. We go back. We read in John 7 what's going on. And we find that Jesus, maybe even some of you, if you just look at the start of chapter 7, mine says, "Jesus at the Feast of Booths." Right? The Feast of Booths, the Feast of the Tabernacles. Now, a few months ago, we talked about these different feasts. And the Feast of Booths, the Feast of the Tabernacles, was a time when the people were remembering their wilderness wanderings. They come to Jerusalem and they dwell in booths, tents. They just set up camp in Jerusalem. And they remember the years that their people spent dwelling in tents in the wilderness. Now, why does this make his claim, "I am the light of the world," a claim to deity? Because what was God doing during that time? God was going before the people as a pillar of light, leading them. Exodus 13, verse 21 and 22 says, "And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people." "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me," that's what they were doing. In the Old Testament, in the wilderness wanderings that they're remembering at the Feast of the Tabernacles, they're remembering the people following that pillar of fire by night that lit their way. "Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." So Jesus claims to be God. And if you claim to be God and you are not God, you're a heretic. So that's the crux of this whole situation we've been looking at here. The Pharisees weren't dumb. They might not have known God, but they knew the rules. And they knew that here, Jesus, in this situation, he was claiming to be God. And if he was bearing false testimony about that, that was heretical. That was worthy of being put to death. That's why this is such a big deal. That's why they have this lengthy discourse afterwards. But what else? What else happens here? What else is going on when he makes this claim to be God, what else is he unveiling by adding the additional word that he is the light of the world? Well, one additional claim is that he will conquer the darkness. Jesus, as the light, shines out into and over all of the darkness. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness. There's so many passages about this in the Old Testament. Psalm 139, verse 11 through 12. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light about me be night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is bright as the day, for darkness is as light with you. The psalmist is saying, even in my darkest hour, when I am with you, I can see. Because even the worst thing that I can imagine, even the darkest moment that I can imagine in this life, if I am with you and in you, I have clarity, I have peace, I have comfort, I have security. Those are the things that light gives us. John 1, verses 4 through 5, in him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. You know, John's writing this after the crucifixion. This is a further testimony about Jesus. He says, listen, there was darkness galore. Darkness put this man on the cross, nailed his hands to the beams, and let him die of blood loss and asphyxiation out in the elements. But darkness has not overcome it, because he rose again and sits at the right hand of the Father. That's why John is writing this book, so that we can know him. It's what he says in 1 John, I write these things that you may know. Right? That is what John is doing, that we may know. That we may know that we can have light in the darkness. You know, when we think about darkness, we think about even the things that have been going on this week. You know, the shootings in Louisiana and in Minneapolis and the, you know, attempt at vengeance that took place in Dallas. It's a dark time. Darkness surrounds us. And we see that people are just combating hatred and evil and anger with more hatred and evil and anger, trying to get vengeance. And Martin Luther King Jr. said this during his time as he was a Christian minister. He said, returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deepener darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. And toughness multiplies toughness in a descending spiral of destruction. And that's the world that we look at when we look at a world full of darkness. And people talk about unity and must join hands, we must be together. But we know what has overcome the darkness. We know where the light is to be found. That is part of what Jesus is saying to these people. He's saying, listen, when you look around you and you see this broken, messed up world, bad things are happening, and people do bad things to get back at people for doing bad things, and it's just this never-ending spiral of destruction. That's not the way it's meant to be. And there's a way out. And we've got that light. And we must shine that light. And that's why we talk about doing things like mercy. Because the church is to be a beacon of light. And sometimes that light comes out in those ways. Of course, the way that it's got to come out the most is in our testimony about the salvation that Jesus provides. Because that is the hope, right? That is the ultimate hope. Can we have unity? Can we have an end to the violence and the anger? Yeah, we can. We will. That's how this book ends. Right? He doesn't leave that question unanswered. It's not here yet, but we hope for it. We wait for it. We long for it. Creation longs for it in the pains of childbirth, Paul says in Romans 8. And by conquering the darkness, Jesus offers salvation, which is freedom from darkness. Right? It's freedom from darkness to all who follow him. Psalm 27, the Lord is my light and my salvation. They're together there. Light and salvation. They're joined. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? And of course, there's no, I don't believe, any greater passage about the connection between light and salvation than what we see in 2 Corinthians 4. 2 Corinthians 4, starting verse 4, says, in their case, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. They're in darkness. To keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. For what we proclaim is not ourselves. This is not worldly wisdom. Right? This isn't something of our own device. But Jesus Christ is Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God who said, let light shine out of darkness. That's how this whole book begins, right? Let the light shine out of the darkness. And yes, that's part of creation, and it's part of the new creation. It's part of the recreation and the regeneration of your soul. God who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shown in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So when God recreates us, when he says, let the light shine in the darkness of this person's life, their soul, that light that shines in our soul is the knowledge of the glory of God in Jesus Christ. Coming to know Christ is coming into the light. And when we look and we see the darkness, it should make us proclaim the light even more. Because people are aware of the darkness. You know, as awful as it is and as terrible as it is that these tragedies happen, we know that God has, throughout history, used terrible circumstances to bring about tremendous change and awakening. People see the darkness. They realize there's darkness, and there is an opportunity for us to bring the light. But we must be willing. We must be bold. We must step forward and do so in love and in mercy and in a commitment to Christ as our Savior. And in our own lives, if we have not done that, if we have not trusted in Christ as our Savior, if we're still in the darkness, for the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers. That's why the Pharisees didn't know him, didn't know who he was, where he came from, what he was doing, because the God of this world had blinded their minds. And until we trust in Christ, we too have blinded minds. And if you find yourself there, if you find yourself in the darkness, if you find yourself groping around, trying to find the answers and the truth and salvation, the way to light, the way to life. Here it is. It's through coming to know Jesus Christ for who he really is. Not as a good teacher. He was a good teacher, but that's not enough to save us. You know? Not as some humble Galilean peasant. Yes, in Philippians we're talking about imitating Christ, and that's part of imitating Christ, is imitating his humility and his servitude. But the only thing about Christ that will save us is Christ as God come down, bearing our sins on the cross, dying in our place, and rising again. And that's where salvation comes from. That's where the light comes from. And if you trust in that, if you believe in that, then you will have the light. God will speak into your soul. He wakes you up, lets the light shine in the darkness, and you'll have salvation. You can trust in that, and that's a message you can take wherever you go. And I promise you, right now, people are at least going to give it a little bit of a listen because they know how much darkness is out there, and everybody's kind of wandering around in this traumatic state from what's happening. And we just got to say to them, yeah, it stinks. This is bad. This is sin. This is the darkness. This is the Bible. This is what God has told us about the darkness and the way out. Let's work there together. Try to find a way to the light. so that we might know Christ, that we might be with him, that we might have what it says at the end. No more pain, no more stress, no more death. Every tear wiped from every eye. Sin will never enter again. And we will live forever praising the glory of God in heaven. Pray with me.